This is the Rob Johnson Show on 640 WGST and 640 WGST.com.
As the disco ball spins high above in the 47-foot ceilings of the studio of Clear Channels Communications at 640 WGST, the Rob Johnson Show rolls on at 6 minutes past 8 o'clock. I am Rob Johnson. A federal judge has ruled Obamacare unconstitutional, and we've got it covered in Georgia here on the Rob Johnson Show. I want to talk next to a guy that knows more about this than you and me put together. Well, first up, a quick mention. At 8:35 this morning, Dr. Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation. He's the healthcare expert for them. 8:50 this morning, Congressman Paul Brown will give his reaction to this Obamacare ruling. Rob Nadelson is one of America's best-known constitutional scholars. For 23 years, he served as professor of law at the University of Montana, where he taught constitutional law, and became a recognized national expert on the framing and adoption of the United States Constitution. In fact, this is the guy that pioneered the use of source material, things like important founding-era law books, which have been overlooked by other writers of the Constitution. And he's been the first to uncover some key facts about some of the most significant parts of the Constitution. There are several keys to his success as a scholar, unlike most constitutional writers. Rob Nadelson has academic training not just in law, nor just in history, but in both, as well as in the Latin classics that were the mainstay of founding-era education. He's written for some of the most prestigious academic publishers, including Cambridge University Press, the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and the Texas Law Review. Rob Nadelson, it is an honor to have you on the program this morning.
It is an honor to be on your program, Rob. In fact, you're famous as well.
I didn't know that.
I've listened to you over the internet. You do a great job.
Thank you very much. Now, tell us what originalist research is, because you pretty much founded that.
Well, I can't say I founded it, but there's no question that I expanded it.
Okay.
Basically, when a lawyer is looking at a document, they want to look at what the people who wrote the document or made the document intended by it. And all originalism is applying the same standard to the Constitution, which the founders would have wanted us to do anyway. But, as the years have rolled on, people have tended to forget a lot of the material that influenced the founders.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they forget the meaning of some of the clauses. One of the most important clauses in the healthcare decision that came out yesterday, for example, a necessary and proper clause, I helped reconstruct the meaning of that because a lot of people have simply forgotten what it meant.
The Necessary and Proper Clause. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with the Good and Welfare Clause, does it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
It's a little different.
Let me play hang on just a minute. Let me play for you, because sure. this is some of the best audio I've ever heard coming out of the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives back when John Conyers was the chairman of that committee. This was in the run-up to the vote on Obamacare. He was asked about the constitutional right that Congress has to mandate that we buy in health insurance. Listen to his response.
What part of the Constitution do you think gives Congress the authority to mandate individuals to purchase health insurance?
Under several clauses. The Good and Welfare Clause and a couple others.
That's
incredible.
Yeah.
This is a guy who took an oath to support this document.
That's right.
He doesn't have a clue what it means, right?
That's right.
What he's referring to is the General Welfare Clause,
yeah.
And when the Constitution was being debated, some of his opponents came up with the idea that the General Welfare Clause would empower the federal government to do almost anything, like maybe force people to eat broccoli,
right,
or buy health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And the advocates of the Constitution said that's ridiculous, it's just a limit on the taxing power, and that's been the consistent position for some time. So the idea that this empowers the federal government to do anything is simply wrong. The clause has been stretched somewhat, but not the way he's suggesting.
Well, the administration and some now in the House of Representatives and in the Senate are saying that the Commerce Clause, in fact, Kathleen Sebelius is the most recent one to say the Commerce Clause gives them the full authority to implement Obamacare. Here's the Health and Human Services Secretary just a couple of days ago.
The two judges that have ruled that this law is constitutional find to be well within the scope of the Commerce Clause.
Is it really?
No. And by the way, it's not the two judges anymore. The score is now 2-2.
That's right.
Now I had two judges in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that these judges always give the benefit of the doubt to Congress. And despite the fact that the Commerce Clause, which is the clause empowering Congress to regulate commerce among the states, originally just trade, even though that clause has been stretched out of recognition by the Supreme Court, they still found that these mandates went beyond the scope of the Commerce Clause. Even the courts that upheld it, would have confessed it was a marginal situation, not well within Congress's power.
Well, the Commerce Clause specifically regulates activity. And
that's right.
I think the judge is saying here that you can't regulate inactivity. I mean, people not buying something can't be regulated according to the Constitutional Commerce Clause.
That's right, Rob. When the Supreme Court has stretched that Commerce Clause to allow Congress to pass all kinds of things that they couldn't do under the original Constitution, they then got faced with the problem is, well, where's the end? I mean, this is supposed to be a government of limited powers. Where do you stop? And where the last two judges have stopped is they've said, look, if you look at the Supreme Court tests, the Supreme Court does give Congress the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate some things like health care that actually are not commerce, but they've always required some kind of activity. Now, the argument of the Obama administration that a clause that regulates activity gives you the power to regulate inactivity reminds me of, there's a section of the Constitution that gives Congress the power to punish piracy.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean Congress has the power to punish Rob Johnson because he's not a pirate? I mean, that's the argument.
Yeah,
that's
well
the
stated.
That's the argument the Obama people made.
Yeah, well stated. Oh, in just a couple of moments, we have to do a quick break here. But in just a couple of moments, I want to talk about the states banding together here against the federal government and where ultimately the Constitution might allow these states to go in taking back some power from the federal government. I mean, this is a fascinating topic right here. We could probably spend a couple of hours on. Back with more in just a couple of seconds with Rob Nadelson this morning, one of America's best-known constitutional scholars. Guys, first, I want to do a favor for you here. You know, Valentine's Day is coming up. And what do we guys always do when we get close to Valentine's Day? We wait till the last minute and then go, oh, my God, I got to get some flowers. Geez, I hope I can get some on time. And by that time, the prices have gone through the roof. I'll tell you right now that you can get 100 blooms in a single vase. It's called 100 Blooms of Love. And, in fact, get a free glass vase for just $19.99. If you'll do it today, $19.99. This comes from Pro Flowers. Now, in addition to that, only radio listeners can get an exclusive upgrade. If you want to do this, you can add chocolates, you can add a teddy bear, and a lavender bath kit for just $10 more. I mean, this is an amazing offer, but you better do it today. If you don't do it today, you're going to forget about it. You're going to miss out on the savings here. These blooms are guaranteed to be delivered on Valentine's Day. They're guaranteed to stay fresh and beautiful for at least 7 days. Here's the only way to get this incredible 100 Blooms of Love offer. Call 800-PRO-FLOWERS. That's 800-PRO-FLOWERS. And mention Rob J. That's R-O-B-J. Or go to proflowers.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in Rob J. Proflowers.com. Click on the microphone, upper right-hand corner, type in Rob J. But do not wait. This offer expires Friday, and before you forget it, I'd do it today.
This is the Rob Johnson Show on 640 WGST. Rob's new to Atlanta and needs to make friends, so connect with him on Facebook. Hit the link at 640WGST.com.
Rob Nadelson is our guest, constitutional scholar, and he's written a book as well I want to be sure you know about this morning. It's called The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. And, Rob, the book is all about the true intent of the founders of the Constitution, because we hear today from so many that want to divert from what the Constitution allows them to do in the federal government. We hear constantly that, well, it is a document that can be changed through time, even without the amendment process, because it is a living document. Was that the original intent of the founders of the nation?
You know, the founders wrote the Constitution to last for the ages, and the main source of flexibility is the formal amendment process. There are some other parts of the Constitution that have a little bit of, give on them. For example, the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures, and what's reasonable or unreasonable will depend on the circumstances. So it's a very, very carefully, one of the things that really came across when I taught the Constitution and when I wrote this book is just how visionary the people who wrote this and adopted this document were, because it's got some absolutely firm rules. It's got some rules with as much flexibility. It doesn't have as much flexibility as those folks want who just want the federal government to run everything, though.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we're going to give away some copies of this book here. I am really big on understanding the Constitution. I think that America's survival lies in the Constitution and the people understanding what the Constitution truly says, what the true intent was. And this book is so accurate and so right on for the original intent of the framers of the Constitution that we're going to give some away and do everything we can to make sure that everybody knows this book is the source to go to for understanding the original intent. Again, it's called The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant, and we have a link on our website to it if you want to go check it out. Now, before we get away from the judge's ruling yesterday, there is a part of the opinion that you say is bad news. What is it?
Yeah, there is. The states had pointed out that the federal government in the health care law had vastly increased their liability under Medicaid, that the federal government had simply mandated that they expand Medicaid greatly, and this was going to bankrupt some of them or at least put them under the gun. They pointed to a 1986 opinion of the Supreme Court, which said that if the conditions on federal aid become severe enough, that's coercion, and we're not going to allow the federal government to coerce the states, even
right.
if the states have bought into a program.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the judge, unfortunately, just kind of blew that off, or that, maybe that's not right, but he dismissed that count, said, I'm not going to get into the business of, you know, how much is too much? How much of a burden is coercive and how much isn't coercive? There's no way I can make that judgment. And you have to sympathize with the judge because it is a tough standard to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have the Supreme Court saying that the states, even when they accept federal aid, can't be coerced. And I think he had an obligation to go to a hearing on that point. Ultimately, the Supreme Court's going to have to straighten that mess out, or otherwise the states are going to be nothing but puppets on a string for the federal government, even more so than today.
I'm so sorry to hear that, because I, for one, don't see how the federal government has the right to tell me that I have to wear a seatbelt in my car. And the way that they go about having local law enforcement enforce that is by telling the states and the municipalities that you're not going to get any federal money for your roads if you don't enforce this law.
That's right. Well, the one case that went to the Supreme Court said it was okay for the federal government to yank 5% of the money for highways if in that case the state didn't raise its drinking age. But this isn't 5%. I mean, this is apparently the whole Medicaid budget, which is a huge component of every state's budget.
Yeah.
And so it looks to me like coercion.
Well, we're seeing 26 states that have banded together now to sue the federal government in regards to the individual mandate with Obamacare. And I'm seeing more and more signs of states wanting to grab that 10th Amendment and take back some of their power from the federal government. How much power does the Constitution say the states should have in relation to the federal government?
According to James Madison and just about everybody else who promoted the Constitution, the powers of the federal government are few and defined, and the states' powers are broad and indefinite. The states are supposed to be the primary source of government in the country, with the federal government focusing on certain important national and international issues, like, for example, national defense.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government is not supposed to be running our schools or telling us that we have to buy health insurance or eat broccoli.
Or telling us what kind of light bulbs we can and cannot buy.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all the kids learn in school that in order to preserve liberty, the founders took the powers of the federal government and they split it among the different branches, executive, judicial, legislative.
Uh-huh.
What doesn't get communicated, and I found this as a law school teacher, what doesn't get communicated is they also left most of the power in the states as a protection for liberty. It's not so much for the benefit of the states, it's not so much states' rights, it's a way of protecting individual liberties by making sure that the central government doesn't get too powerful and abusive.
I want to talk for just a moment, and we just have a couple of moments left here, but I want to talk, because you wrote a document called Paper Money and the Original Understanding of the Coinage Clause.
Yes.
And
yes.
By the way, we have a link on our website on the Rob Johnson Show page that takes you to a wealth of information written by this constitutional scholar we have on the phone with us here. I recommend you, for any reference to the Constitution, you go to that page and save this as a favorite on your computer. But I'm curious here. The Federal Reserve seems to me to be unconstitutional on every level. Is it?
That's a question that was really debated as early as 1789 when the bill was offered to introduce the first national bank.
Mm-hmm.
Congress, which consisted at the time largely of framers of the Constitution and other founders, ultimately reached the conclusion, which President Washington agreed with, that it was constitutional. James Madison initially opposed it. He eventually came around. I'm inclined to think that the idea of a national bank, whether it's a good idea or not, different from what's constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inclined to think that the institution is constitutional, but the scope of the powers is not. In other words, Congress doesn't have a constitutional power to regulate the whole economy. To fiddle with the currency is a way of manipulating people's wealth or redistributing people's wealth. But in some ways, that's how the Federal Reserve has been used. So you have to make a distinction. First off, you have to say, whether it's constitutional, it's different from whether it's a good idea. And secondly, it might be constitutional if it had just a few narrow powers, but it can be unconstitutional if it has really broad powers.
Exactly. Well, again, that's a whole subject for a conversation at another time, because that is quite extensive. But there is so much information here that you've written that we're making available to our listeners through the website, that I'm excited to have this in the hands of so many people that can make a difference in the world
today. One thing I want to emphasize about the book, The Original Constitution, Rob, is that this is not my opinions or my wish constitution speaking. This is the real thing, and I called it as I saw it, even when I disagreed with the founders, which happened on occasion.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more thing before I let you go here this morning. Chuck Schumer is one of the more brilliant minds in the Senate of the United States, and I just want you to hear his description of the three branches of government. Are you seated, by the way, Rob?
I think I've heard this, but
okay.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, you might ought to put your seatbelt on if just to be sure. But listen to this.
You know, we have three branches of government. We have a House, we have a Senate, we have a President, and all three of us are going to have to come together and give some.
There you go.
I think Senator Schumer might have gotten a rude awakening yesterday when the Federal District Court essentially informed him that, well, there's another branch of government, it's called the judiciary. and the other thing he forgot is that, of course, most government is supposed to be at the local level. And he does tend to overlook that.
Right, but it's supposed to be from the grassroots up. Well,
right.
I really appreciate your time this morning. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I do want to spend a little more time with you, Rob, as we move through this Obamacare. But there are so many other issues, too, regarding the Constitution that I want to refer to you on. If it's okay with you, we'll talk more often.
You bet.
Good.
Thanks,
good.
Rob.
Thanks very much. And again, links on our website for Rob Nadelson, constitutional scholar, professor of law for many, many years, now retired and serving on a think tank and just writing a lot of wonderful documents. Again, if you have any question about any aspect of the Constitution, we have a link right now on our webpage that'll take you to so many of the documents that he's written. Some are books, but for the most part, most of them are PDFs of papers that he's written that you can download into your computer and read them anytime. And it is a wealth of information on the true meaning and intent of the Constitution, as well as links to his book, which we'll be giving away en masse soon here on The Rob Johnson Show.
This is The Rob Johnson Show on 640 WGST and 640WGST.com.
Congressman Paul Brown, always an interesting conversationalist, joins us at 8:50 this morning here on The Rob Johnson Show. It's 8:35 now. And you can catch us online at 640WGST.com. Just click on The Rob Johnson Show. We have links to the guests we have on the program and to more valuable resources. And over on the left side of the page, you'll see a little box there where you can listen just with a click to interview segments of the program and various and sundry things that we do here on the program. I want to continue with the subject here of the judge's ruling yesterday that Obamacare is unconstitutional. Now, again, the ruling was specifically on the individual mandate, but because the individual mandate is not severable from the rest of Obamacare, the judge thereby ruled that Obamacare should be void. Dr. Merrill Matthews is with the Institute of Policy Innovation. He's resident scholar with the Institute. He's also a health policy expert, past president of the Health Economics Roundtable for the National Association for Business Economics, the largest trade organization of business economists. And he joins us this morning here on the program. Dr. Matthews, hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How's Atlanta?
It's doing quite well this morning. We're a little foggy and a little wet, but we don't have any ice, so we can't complain.
Well, I'm in Dallas. We can complain.
No kidding. Well, I'm always glad when you can join us to talk about the issues of health care, particularly in the wake of this big ruling yesterday. Now, I'm right, aren't I, that the judge just ruled that the individual mandate was not constitutional?
Yes, that's right. The individual mandate, and because so many elements are intertwined, which is what the administration has been claiming itself. That the whole thing falls. Now, to some extent, I think that's a bit of an overstatement, because there's lots of pork in the bill that's easily severable. For instance, they put $15-16 billion in a prevention fund for things like lights at stadiums and thing and bike paths and walking paths and things like that. Now, you could that shouldn't be there, but you could conceivably that could go on even if the rest of the health insurance provision falls apart.
Right, sure. Now, so again, the individual mandate is meant to cover health insurance for all of us, but it's also supposed to cover what you just mentioned. I mean,
that's why I say the judge by basically bringing down the whole thing. There's parts that you could sever.
Uh-huh.
What the judge said, it was a very interesting comment. He said, It would be almost impossible for us as judges to try to ascertain what's severable and what isn't severable from this legislation.
Uh-huh.
We don't know enough about this to go and try to say, well, this part, and this part you can leave in, but these parts can have to go. So he just essentially found the whole thing unconstitutional. And it was a major sweeping statement that I think some of us thought really probably was correct in a lot of ways.
Right, but I think so many people, though, just to go back what you said there just a second ago, really spurred something in my brain that so many people, as we hear Obamacare discussed, understand that this is a health care program, not realizing that so much of the money that's being spent to support this program is also being spent to do things, as you said, build bicycle paths and make nice, happy places for people to go because, again, in the name of better health care. And this is all we're paying for all of this as part of Obamacare is quite shocking to some.
That's right, and even like the new independent panel advisory board, which is meant to essentially look over the healthcare system and determine what's working, what isn't working, make suggestions, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, I mean, you could leave that or kick that out. That's not essential to the basic parts of the legislation of getting people insured.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of us have been very concerned that it's going to go around and start rationing care and so forth. You could leave that, but that's the kind of thing where the judge says we don't know whether or not this is really integral to the legislation or not, so he's tossing the whole thing out.
Now, I know this ruling just came down yesterday, but I'm curious, through your sources in Washington, D.C., does this mean the Republicans are going to kind of sit back and wait until the Supreme Court rules on this, or are they going to go full force ahead? Has this, in fact,
Republicans would like to move this fairly quickly ahead,
mm-hmm.
and would like to have expedited review of from the Supreme Court. It is the Democrats in this case who don't want that to happen. Their goal is to let the legislation and the court challenge drag out as long as possible so that as much as possible of the legislation is implemented as a way of saying, well, we can't eliminate this now because states have gone so far to implement this thing.
Uh-huh.
So many things have happened, and to try to undermine the thing now would create a real havoc in the system.
All right. So do you have any feeling as to how the Supreme Court might rule on this when and if they eventually get it? And surely they will.
I don't. I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal a week ago where I said, President Obama would actually be wise to signal to Republicans that he would support ending
mm-hmm.
individual mandates simply because if if this goes to the Supreme Court, you've got four left, four right, and then Justice Kennedy kind of in the has become the swing vote. And who knows? I mean, it may depend upon whether or not he had a bad night's sleep as to how he decides on something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And the real problem for the administration is Democrats were never really big supporters in general of the mandate. What they wanted to do was they wanted to require health insurance to accept anyone who applies regardless of a medical condition. And the insurance industry came up and said, well, if you're going to make us do that, then you've got to put everybody in the system so that people don't just stay, wait until they get health, until they need medical health care to get the insurance. So the insurance industry pushed that. You know, President Obama never campaigned on the individual mandate. That wasn't part of his plan. It was part of Hillary Clinton's plan, but it
right.
wasn't part of his.
That's right.
So you've got this interesting thing that in order to make sure that insurance companies accept everybody, they've embraced the individual mandate. And that's what may ultimately bring down their whole legislation. Ironically, Republicans have historically, a lot of Republicans have been generally for the individual mandate requiring people to have health insurance. They were less comfortable with the pre-existing condition provision, but now they're going to kill the individual mandate. But a lot of them say, well, we do that, but we'll still keep that pre-existing condition clause in there, which actually creates more havoc in the healthcare system.
All right. Well, we appreciate your expertise this morning on this, Dr. Matthews. We'll talk again soon, all right?
Thank you, sir.
You bet. Dr. Merrill Matthews, the Institute for Policy Innovation. It's 8:42 now. Switching subjects here to Mayor Bloomberg of New York City and a sting operation that he ran. It prompted by last month's Tucson tragedy, which killed six, injured 13. New York City, at the request of Mayor Bloomberg, sent undercover agents to a gun show to demonstrate how easy it is to purchase weapons. This sting was conducted not in New York City, not within the boundaries of New York State, but in Arizona, in Phoenix specifically. Here's Mayor Bloomberg from his press conference yesterday.
After the tragic massacre in Tucson, we decided to investigate the issue in Arizona and sent an undercover team to the Crossroads of the West gun show in Phoenix on January 23rd. And today we're going to show you some video footage of a few different transactions at that gun show.
And he went on to show some video of the hidden camera sting operation conducted in Phoenix. I mean, who does this guy think he is? He's not the Attorney General of the United States. He's not the FBI director. He's the mayor of one city in the United States. And why is he going after Arizona? I mean, this state's already fighting the Obama administration's full frontal assault from several federal government agencies and departments. I mean, what's Bloomberg up to? You know, he talked about running for president in the last election as a Republican. But he just blew his chance at ever being a candidate for the Republican Party with this action. But you know what? I think he probably strengthened his opportunity to become Obama's vice presidential running mate in 2012. I'm not kidding around. I think he's up to something here.
You're listening to The Rob Johnson Show on 640 WGST and 640WGST.com.
.848, 12 minutes until 9 o'clock, just a couple minutes away from our guest Paul Brown that'll talk about his reaction to the ruling yesterday by Judge Vinson about Obamacare. Our phone number is 404-367-9478. That's 404-367-WGST. Very interesting yesterday that Judge Vinson, in striking down the individual mandate in Obamacare, used the president's words himself. He used the words of Barack Obama when Obama was a senator running for president. When late in the campaign, when it was just down to him and Hillary running for the Democrat nomination for president, that it became very clear that Obama did not want to run on a health care reform that included an individual mandate. In fact, Obama had said on CNN these words.
If a mandate was the solution, we could try that to solve homelessness by mandating everybody buy a house.
So Judge Vinson included those words in his ruling yesterday. It was a footnote near the end of his 75-page ruling. Now, this is interesting on a number of levels. You know what? I want to go back and I want to play you the... No, I don't want to because I think Paul Brown's going to join us right now. And that's too long of a piece of audio to bring to you this morning. We'll do it perhaps tomorrow morning. Play the extended version of that conversation on CNN. where we hear the absolute shunning. In fact, the guy was turning away from any individual mandate, saying Hillary Clinton's plan for health care reform was totally off base because she was demanding an individual mandate. And he thought that was totally wrong. And now we find the individual mandate is the core of Obamacare. I just have trouble putting together all of this. It's really tough for me to keep up with. Well, let's see if Congressman Paul Brown's having any better luck at it. Congressman Brown joins us here this morning at 10 minutes till 9 o'clock. Hey, Congressman, how you doing?
Good morning, Rob. How are you this morning?
Really, really good.
I'm feeling great because this judge finally is one who looked at the Constitution and understands that all of the bill is unconstitutional. It's not just a individual mandate, but even the mandate on the states. That bill, if it was ever, or that law, if it was ever put into full effect, would destroy jobs. In fact, some experts have said it would destroy up to over 5 million jobs in America.
Mm-hmm.
Those many people out of work.
Mm-hmm.
It will destroy budgets, both family budgets as well as state budgets, particularly state budgets because of the expansion of Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
It will destroy the quality of health care because what's going to happen is there's going to be a tremendous amount of rationing. We already have a doctor shortage. There's going to the Democrats in the stimulus bill put together something then with this bill, what's called comparative effectiveness, where they're going to utilize age and dollars to compare how they're going to deliver care.
Wait a minute. This is the death panel.
That's right.
I mean, that's what their decision-making powers would be, to determine who does in the later stages of life, or if you're of such an extreme affliction that you're not likely to survive, it may not be cost-worthy to give you some government money to fix yourself.
Or if you're elderly and they think you're going to die anyway, then they're not going to spend any money on you. So it's a rationing panel. Some people call it a death panel. But they're... Thankfully, the judge has overthrown it. The Republicans in the U.S. House have passed a bill to repeal Obamacare, and I've introduced a bill that would repeal Obamacare and replace it with four things. The first is across state line purchases of insurance.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that anybody, a business or an individual, could join an association. You'd have these huge pools of folks all across the country, which would lower the cost of insurance, give people multiple insurance products that they could buy.
Uh-huh.
Third thing would stimulate the states to set up high-risk pools. And the fourth thing is to have 100% tax deductibility for all health care expenses for everybody, including health insurance. Those four things would radically change the cost of health care downward. It would lower the cost of health care. Now, that's not a comprehensive bill. I introduced that last time, too. It's called the Patient Option Act, which is 106 pages, by the way, not almost 3,000, but three out of four Americans right now today would like to see us do this in a step-by-step manner. And my bill that I just discussed would be a huge first step to literally lower the cost of health care. Now, Obamacare, if it stayed on the books, would drive up the cost of care. In fact, the administration just recently admitted that it's not going to lower it.
Right, exactly.
They talked about universal coverage, but that's not going to happen under Obamacare either. So it was just actually a huge power grab,
in my opinion.
It's not going to do what they said it was going to do. And thankfully, the judge has said it's thrown out. Hopefully, the Supreme Court will uphold this ruling, and we can put in place something that makes sense, like the bills I just discussed.
Right, right. Now, I want to talk about one of those in specific, a couple of them perhaps. Of course, purchasing insurance across state lines, that brings nationwide competition among insurance companies, which would certainly, we all understand that. But you're talking about the pools where businesses and companies could all pool together. Would they, tell me how that would work. Would that be in itself an insurance policy, or would they pool together and then go purchase insurance from a company?
No, they would. Well, it could be any which way that the pool wanted to do. But first, I'm a Rotarian. We could have a Rotary International pool, so everybody who is a Rotarian, has been a Rotarian, is married to a Rotarian, has business with a Rotarian, anybody that has any connection with a Rotary Club could purchase insurance in a rotary pool so that you would have thousands, hundreds of thousands potentially in one pool. You could have a college graduate pool. I'm a University of Georgia graduate. You could have a UGA pool, or it could be a college graduate pool, or a college, anybody who attended college, even there wasn't a college
graduate. So right now, most of us, the primary choice that we, the choice we always go with, for the most part, when it's available, is to go through our employee-provided health insurance. This would give us so many other options, all these other pools out there that we might have access to, that, again, it increases competition and rates go down. Is that the intended purpose?
Absolutely. And plus, it would help cover those people who can't get coverage now, because if they have prior conditions or what have you, and they fit in that pool, you'd have so many people in the pool that it would lower each person's risk to the insurance company. So it would help cover those that are uninsurable. And then the other thing, it would give ownership to the individual, so that would solve the portability problem also.
Yeah, no kidding.
So it would solve a lot of the problems that we have today. And you would have, I buy my insurance in the federal government pool.
Uh-huh.
Now, a lot of people think members of Congress get free health insurance. We don't. I buy it. Mine's a Blue Cross Blue Shield PPO.
Uh-huh.
My postman could buy the same insurance policy at the same rate that I do.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about federal insurance is that you have this huge pool so that everybody's covered.
Right.
And what this does is it puts market-based, patient-centered solutions in the healthcare system, and it gives the patients the control over what kind of insurance that they want to buy.
Sure. Well, I like the idea, Congressman.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I like the idea. Anytime you increase competition, you see better service, and you see rates go down. So I think that's quite a good idea.
Rob, I believe very firmly in the marketplace. I think the marketplace is unencumbered by restrictions from government regulation.
Right.
Now, and taxes is the best way to control quality, quantity, and cost of all goods and services, including health insurance, and that's what we need to look to.
Sure. We just have about a minute left, but I want to play you a piece of audio here this morning, because I know you're big on the Constitution. We've talked about that before here.
Right.
I want to play you some audio from Chuck Schumer this morning that might illustrate why we're having so many problems with unconstitutional efforts coming out of the halls of Congress. This, again, is the brilliant Senator Chuck Schumer.
You know, we have three branches of government. We have a House, we have a Senate, we have a President, and all three of us are going to have to come together and give some.
The three branches of of government.
Oh, boy.
From Senator Chuck Schumer.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
He's an attorney, I think, too, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Remember, he's a brilliant mind. He's been in the Senate for a long, long time, and you have to be really smart to do that.
Well, some people would argue that.
Yeah, no kidding. Isn't that symptomatic, though, of so many of the problems out of Washington, D.C. right now? It's just that we have people that have been sitting there in seats of power for so long that have no idea what the Constitution allows them to do or not do.
You're absolutely right. In fact, in Hosea 4:6, God says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." And I encourage people to read the Constitution, read what our founding fathers said about it, and understand that the federal government is only supposed to be doing 18 things, 18 things that are listed in Article 1, Section 8. My job as a U.S. Congressman, or Chuck Schumer's job as a U.S. Senator, should be a part-time job under the original intent of the Constitution.
There you go.
And we've perverted it. Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives have perverted it and distorted it. We need to return back to the original intent of the Constitution. There are very few of us in Washington. We, the people, can demand a different kind of governance, and that's exactly what we need to be doing.
And with that, Congressman, we'll have to say goodbye, but I appreciate your time again this morning. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
We've got links to his website on ours at 640wgst.com. Just click on the Rob Johnson Show.